You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. The word of God for the people of God. So, hyper literally, like exactly as it's worded, it's do not answer or respond, do not answer against your neighbor as a false witness. Right? So the idea of witness there, and the English is totally fine, you know, that's capturing the sense. But the idea there of the witness isn't the testimony that you give, it's you yourself. Do not appear, do not be a witness of falsehood. So this envisions, obviously, a legal proceeding where someone makes an accusation against another, and then various witnesses are called before an authority to tell what it is that they saw, right? But, like the other commands, it points way beyond the literal language of a legal proceeding to all sorts of things that we say. And then really, once you start thinking about the things that we say, it points to really pretty deep issues about the gap between what we perceive and then what actually really is. God is deeply concerned with justice, okay? God is deeply, deeply concerned with justice. And the proper administration of what is fair or just requires an accurate knowledge of the facts, right? To deliver justice, one has to have a clear understanding of what has actually happened. God, of course, knows exactly what has gone on, but he is so serious about his original intention that we should be his image in the world, represent him, and share in his work, that he administers justice, for the most part, through human agents. And these human agents are absolutely not all-knowing the way that he is, and require good information in order to understand what has happened, in order to understand what is actually just. And again, this goes way beyond the law court. Anyone who needs to make a just decision needs accurate information. A judge presides over child custody proceedings, right? Apologies if this touches bad memories or triggers for anyone. Each of the former spouses brings forth several character witnesses, right? Each character witness goes on with long stories of how patient and kind and responsible one spouse is, while the other one is just a total monster, right? There might be some concrete incidents that are related that both sides acknowledge happened, but those incidents are going to be presented so differently that there's just no overlap between them. A different situation, a parent breaks in on two siblings, ready to rip each other's throats out, right? What does the parent say? What happened? Right? And then he hears, or she hears, two totally different stories, right? That Bobby's hand came in contact with Jimmy's nose, which is now bleeding, is agreed upon, but the similarities in the two stories absolutely end there. Right? Financial aid office has people, right, whose job it is to see that people are able to get an education, but there's limited funds, and so they sincerely endeavor to divide it up equitably, justly, dependent on people's needs. For that, they need a lot of information, right? People used to groan about the FAFSA. The FAFSA is nothing compared to the CSS profile. Right? Does anybody have to do the CSS profile? Oh, you okay? So one other person. Yeah, it's the FAFSA on steroids. Voters are presented with a referendum, right? About power lines, maybe, right? Or the growing and selling of certain green plants, right? These voters want good, objective information. We want actual facts about the costs, about the benefits, about the detriments, about what's been tried in other states. But instead of facts, all we get are lots of flashy mailings that each contain a bit of truth and a ton of spin, right? Stringing out a narrative that exaggerates here, minimizes there, misrepresents, and quotes out of context. All of this without accurate understanding, there's no way to pursue justice. At the first level, the command envisions out and out lying, right? In the Old Testament, King Ahab of the northern kingdom of Israel wanted to buy somebody's land, right, for a vegetable garden because it bordered on his own estate. But the man refused to sell it, right? Family land is often very important in Israel, especially so back at this time. So Ahab's wife, the infamous Jezebel, said, "Don't sweat it. I got this." Right? She wrote to the elders of the man's city saying, "At town meeting, have someone get up and accuse him of blasphemy, and then have several others stand up and say that they heard the exact same thing. Then stone him." And that's exactly what happened. This kind of straightforward false witness, of course, still goes on today, and I suspect far, far more frequently than we would like to think. None of us, I think, have sat in a witness box and intentionally lied. Again, you're welcome to come and tell me otherwise. But think of all the times that we provide information and then sign at the bottom, right? Even if there isn't that line that says, "I attest that the foregoing information is complete and accurate to the best of my knowledge," that is still what our signature means. Like last week, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of playing that game of coming up with more and more trivial examples, but I think we really do need, in that moment, to stop and think in terms of moral, ethical questions before God and not legal questions or questions of what do most people do? What is acceptable? What's a norm here? I remember helping a Russian Christian to fill out an application to emigrate to the U.S. as a victim of religious persecution. I was kind of surprised at the things that he was claiming as persecution. When he first told me, I was kind of skeptical because, I lived there among them. I knew what daily life was like, and he certainly didn't seem persecuted to me. But I thought, you know, there might be stuff that I don't know about. And so we met with him and started like filling out the form and all that stuff. And when I saw what he was claiming as persecution, I was unimpressed. And honestly, I was actually a little bit angry. And I felt that it was dishonest. And I told him that I was not going to help, you know, that it's not my place to tell him what he can and can't do. But I was not going to be a part of it. I found out afterwards that as he thought about what I had said, he chose to apply to emigrate without refugee status, which I believe he was successful in, he did. And doing it without refugee status simply meant that he didn't receive a whole lot of helps along the way. He didn't receive a lot of financial assistance and other perks that, honestly, he didn't need. Often we think this is excusable because there's no victim as far as we can see, right? And I've even heard people go back to the command and say, "Do not be a lying witness against your neighbor," right? And so if they can't identify the person being hurt, then it's like, well, then what's the problem here, right? There's actually pretty significant or big in the news court case right now where that argument is being made. We don't see a neighbor whom we're bearing witness against, but the victim is still there, right? If you make some questionable decisions while filing your taxes, for instance, it's hard to think of the U.S. government as the victim, right? It's hard to think that the U.S. budget is like suffering loss because you tweak something here or there. But if you multiply those little deceits by 20 million, okay? I didn't pull that figure out of the air. I did a quick little search, and that's the actual kind of estimate, that roughly 5%, they're close to 200 million returns filed each year. Roughly 5% say they always lie on their taxes. Roughly 6% say they often do. That's combined 11%, 20 million. Okay? So multiply all those little deceits by 20 million, and suddenly that harm done to systems which are supposed to like ensure that our society works, that becomes really significant. And then when you think about all those societal systems that are like supposed to work, and you think who suffers the harm when they don't work, it is actually the most vulnerable people, right? Which is something we're becoming very aware of with all these kind of talk about the disparity in different areas. You don't see the neighbor that your false witness harms, but God does. But I think where we are most touched by this is something that's a lot more subtle than outright deceit, whether it's in a witness box or on forms of whatever kind. And that is our tendency to think in terms of subjective experience instead of objective fact, right? Objective fact, that's what happened. Subjective experience is, what was it like for me to live through that? When you hear someone describe what happened to them, especially if they were hurt in some way, you will seldom, if ever, get a cut and dry, bare bones relating of the facts, just the facts, ma'am. What you will get is a narrative. You'll get a story of what it was like to live through it, what it was like to experience the facts, right? Which, of course, is the intersection of the facts and then the person. It's as though the camera is not looking from outside the action, the way we typically watch TV or whatever, but is being shot from the person's eyes. And as most of us, I am sure, have experienced, when two people take their stories and try to, when two people are in a conflict and try to work back through it together, it can be nearly impossible to get to what happened through the fog of how they each experienced it. There is always some gap between the objective fact of what happened and the subjective experience of those who were there. There will always be a gap. That's the reality, okay? And in our good desire to show compassion by listening to people's experiences and validating what they have experienced, our culture today has elevated people's subjective experiences. Okay? Now, that is largely a good thing. That is a good thing. We should not be concerned with the facts and just the facts when people are hurting. They need to be listened to. They need to understand that there is compassion. They need to understand that they are heard. Okay? But we've emphasized validating someone's subjective experience to the point where often we no longer are concerned with finding the objective fact behind the person's experience. We've become so accustomed to taking each person's story as lived that people have largely decided or passively swallowed the idea that objective fact or truth is fundamentally unknowable. Right? In that struggle of the hard, seemingly impossible task of getting to objective fact behind people's stories, people have decided, oh, well, in that case, there is no such thing. Okay? Increasingly, people don't even think there are facts to be found behind each person's subjective experience. There is only 2 or 3 or 4 or 200 million subjective experiences. Which, there is no effect, there is only the subjective experience, which cannot and need not be reconciled with any other person's subjective experience. Right? Now think about that. That sounds just kind of to the modern person, right? Like, that's giving every person justice. Really listening to them, validating their experience, standing with them with whatever it is that they've lived through. But the reality is, it undercuts justice. Because without being able to get past people's subjective experiences to the objective what happened, there's no basis to determine what is just. I mean, I could run through every news story that is current today, and this is like at the heart of it. We have a world that is passionately concerned with justice, but cannot identify what is just. This is how the very necessary observation that people who have very different lived experiences of the same situation becomes the common assertion that that's your truth, but she has her truth. Okay? That statement is extremely well-intentioned. They just get one word wrong. That is your experience. She has her own experience. Amen. But truth is something else. There's one truth that is behind your experience and her experience. Without being able to do that, you know, I'm going to go there. I'm going to pull a story out of the news. What's going on in the Middle East right now? You probably went there already, right? If it's only people's subjective experiences, which, let's face it, that's what the news stories always are. On the ground, eyewitness reporting of the atrocities, and then next week it's the atrocities on the other side. And the whole world pivots in a moment. These are the victims. They need justice. And then next week, no, these people are the victims. They need justice. Right? But as long as we're only looking at subjective experience, there can't even be a conversation about what is just. We genuinely experience the situations in radically different ways, but somewhere there is one truth behind both experiences. Right? Again, I don't want to like hit on all the political issues of the day, but this is the trend that eventually lets a White House press secretary justify policy decisions by claiming alternative facts. Okay? So a big step back from the big news stories, right? Married couples, when you are in a really unpleasant argument, I hope it is very rare, but it happens, doesn't it? I mean the uncommon ones, the ones that are really, really, really unpleasant. When you are both feeling deeply, deeply, deeply hurt by the other person. Have you noticed how hard it is as you try to work through that not to twist the other person's words? I mean, it's practically impossible. We all want the other person to hear what we are trying to say and not get hung up on the particular words that we used, right? But when they want the same, we jump right in with, "But you said..." Similarly, when we assume that the way a person's words make us feel must be what they intended, in effect, attributing another's motives based on our own reactions, we are essentially bearing false witness within our heart to ourselves against them. When we tell our stories, we can't help but want to present ourselves as the offended party, because that's how we genuinely feel. And so, as we tell our stories, we pass over some bits. We exaggerate others. We add spin, right, by carefully choosing our words to magnify one aspect and minimize another. And as I've said, when we're sharing our story with a friend in order for them to understand our experience and support us in our difficulty, that's natural and it's understandable. But when we are in conversation with a judge, with a parent, with a teacher, with a pastor, with any other person in a position of trying to help resolve a conflict, or if we're just trying to resolve a conflict with another person and we're not before any other third person other than God, in that case, the goal is not to simply be understood, to do that, but then hopefully to help both parties work past the subjective experience and come to the objective facts of what happened. And in that process, you may lose some of your self-perceived innocent victim status, but what do you gain in exchange? You win in a healed relationship. You win in peace going forward. You win in trust being built. You win in the building up of peace and justice. So now, take a big step back from your own experiences and what you should or shouldn't do, and as we've been doing all through the series, imagine a world where this sort of narrative spinning is unheard of, when nobody can even imagine that such a thing would happen, right? Imagine a world where even if people are genuinely hurt by the words or actions of others, or otherwise find themselves in conflict, that they're actually able to see past their own experience and evaluate what actually happened. People who can say, "Well, this is what you did, but this is how I felt. And I want you to understand how I felt, but I recognize that this is all that you did." Right? Imagine that world where people who step in to try and help both parties in a conflict are able to do so because both parties are forthright and honest, refusing to indulge themselves in narratives that cast them in the best light. I have not often, as a pastor, been pulled into a real high-level conflict. But every single time I have been utterly unable to do anything. Imagine a world where people can actually help. That's a world that is positioned to see real healing. That's a world where interpersonal wounds can be healed. That's a place where international conflicts can be resolved and everything in between. And that is the kind of world that God wants. So, what now? What do I expect you to do this week? Right? That's a good exercise for a pastor to do as he's writing a sermon. What do I actually expect you to go do this week? Because you heard these amazing, deep, insightful, emotionally moving, and intellectually... Okay. Well, now that you know the difference, never do it again. Yeah, right. Not going to happen. We are all far more complicated than that. Like the other commands, when we understand what God is talking about, we don't suddenly say, oh, well, I won't do that again. No, the command exposes that our whole way of doing life is deeply entrenched in sin. So that when faced with a call to like do things differently, we're like, what do I do? Right? Where do I even start? So what do I expect? Well, to be honest, I expect that someday, maybe this week, maybe later, you'll be doing something, right? Maybe filling out a tax return or a FAFSA, maybe answering somebody's question of, hey, what happened between you and him? Maybe in a conflict with a spouse or a coworker, maybe even talking to a lawyer, right? And as you write down a number or you start to tell your side of the story, I actually really do expect that some point, somewhere, someday, a little voice is going to whisper, is that how it really happened? Or is that the whole number? Is that what she really said? And then I really do expect that you will pause and just take a step backwards. A step back towards the objective truth. And because of that, the world will actually be just a little bit more like the world that God desires.